power has forever been entwined with a symbolic apparatus in charge of representing it. From Louis XIV in France to Queen Victoria in England, images and rituals have served to strengthen people's connections to governing institutions. Symbols and rites.
I need to speak up a little.
Okay.
Oh. Make power more tangible and appealing. Although the Enlightenment's emphasis on rational practices highlighted the risk of a decision-making process that strayed from legal procedures, in the 18th century there also emerged a whole philosophical movement that argued that beauty could articulate political morality. Beauty was supposed to motivate people's actions with the indirect result of guiding them towards the common good. As aesthetics slowly became entangled with politics, competing interpretations of how this relationship should unfold came to the fore. Eventually, beauty was conceived instrumentally, reduced to style, and devoid of content. Fascism was one of the first movements to take advantage of aesthetics' original radical political impulse, while also simplifying its moral reach. This paper examines Mussolini's approach to politics as an utmost example of the degrading process aesthetics underwent at the turn of the 20th century, a most perniciously successful implementation of the aestheticization of politics. I will first discuss the relationship between politics and aesthetics in modernity by focusing on the genealogy and consequences of what I see as the entanglement of these two value spheres. To this end, I will first review the historical philosophical process that led to the proclamation of arts autonomy in the 19th century with the Arts for Art's Sake movement, and the path that led art to be identified as a disinterested social realm detached from the passions and urges of daily life. I will then focus on the case of Mussolini in fascist Italy and show the several ways in which aesthetics affected Mussolini's conception of politics and the way he exercised power. Because of our limited time, this discussion will necessarily be sketchy, but I hope it will add to our thinking about the issues posed by the conference. As several scholars have argued, the concept of autonomous disinterested art emerged as the result of a complex historical process originating in the 18th century in Britain. At the time, moralists of the caliber of Addison, Shaftesbury, Hutcheson, Hume, and Allison set out to address the status of egoism and instrumentality in ethical questions. Lord Shaftesbury, in particular, developed a notion of disinterestedness at first linked to moral issues. Later, disinterestedness became the core concept of modern aesthetic theory and the key methodological principle in the newly emerging discipline of aesthetics. Critical of interest in its meaning as strategic when applied to motives for action, Shaftesbury was also opposed to the idea of considering ethics in terms of an action's consequences, i.e. whether or not the action had positive effects on the common good. He argued that disinterestedness served to overcome what he considered the false choice between egoism and altruism. Disinterestedness implied that moral life was not concerned with action, but instead was fundamentally concerned with harmony and contemplation. Within this framework, virtuous man was like the art lover, and virtue was not about making the right decisions in view of reaching worthy ends. Virtue rather stood for no other than the love of order and beauty. That's a quote. At first preoccupied with moral issues, over time Shaftesbury turned his ethical concerns into an aesthetically informed theory that emphasized the importance of beauty and contemplation when defining a virtuous person. Thus, whereas he had originally discussed disinterest in opposition to interest in practical actions, Shaftesbury later employed disinterest to refer to the virtuous man as a spectator keen on contemplating the beauty of both manners and morals. Disinterestedness was contrary to action and also dismissive of the desire to possess or use a thing. It emphasized the perceiving act when contemplating an object rather than the object being contemplated. Shaftesbury's conception of disinterestedness shifted toward the perceptual, and in view of aesthetics' etymological meaning as sense perception, made it possible for the first time to think about a novel construct, that of aesthetic disinterestedness. Disinterestedness was connected with aesthetics rather than ethics. An emphasis was increasingly placed on the recipient's experience and their capacity to contemplate an object. As long as one remained a spectator, one's experience of an object would supposedly be disinterested because it was based solely on perception. The perceptual experience of beauty was then emphasized rather than the qualities that made a thing beautiful. Since all objects of disinterested perception could provide sensate experience, aesthetics ascended to the position of a more general and encompassing theory that reached beyond art forms and genres and included literature and music, as well as nature and the sciences. This new perspective on experience marked the birth of aesthetics as a distinctive realm. Eventually, good taste was adopted as an evaluative tool and linked to the pleasure of the imagination and lack of desire for possessions. In Germany, judgment of taste became central to Kant's influential redefinition of aesthetic essence and came to be identified by Kant with the human ability to share experiences in comparison to animals. For Kant, disinterestedness in aesthetic judgment signified that taste, though subjective because based on feelings rather than concepts, was not arbitrary or private. It involved, at least in principle, the existence of what he called a sensus communis, or common sense, intended not in the ordinary meaning of simple, but rather in the sense of shared. Aesthetic judgment for Kant required consensual understanding within a collectivity. Thus, on the one hand, disinterestedness implied that the crucial factor in our experience of a beautiful object was not the object itself, but the feelings of enjoyment it aroused in us. On the other hand, through reference to sensus communis, disinterestedness also implied that those feelings, being in principle communicable and intersubjective, were not based on personal or sensual gratification and did not implicate a utilitarian dimension. Kant's famous definition of art as purposiveness without purpose helped solidify the identification of the aesthetic realm with known instrumental ends. For Kant, this did not mean that art should be disconnected from social life. In contrast, art provided an ideal space within which to envision a public forum away from concrete political or governmental action, and where enlightened citizens could freely discuss political issues. Art was a self-proclaimed non-political space in which politics, however, worked as a motivational engine. In this sense, although seemingly founded on separation, modern aesthetics originated in relation to politics. Eventually, the connection between politics and aesthetics became elusive. The doctrine of art for art's sake, which became prominent in the 19th century, stripped aesthetics of its political impulse and eliminated from it the idea of perception and the body. It also managed to naturalize its own notion of art as autonomous, autotelic, and self-referential. Now, how is all this discussion of aesthetics connected to Mussolini? Over a number of years now, my investigations into Italian fascism have revolved around the centrality of aesthetics in Mussolini's conception and exercise of power. What do I mean by conception of power? In my view, Mussolini's subscription to aesthetics was not a superficial move, was not a strategic approach geared to maintaining or holding on to power. It was not a mere use of symbols or art, which is most often what one thinks of as aesthetics, but a deeper identification of politics with the ideals of beauty, an identification that informed Mussolini's conception of power. As for how Mussolini exercised power, my argument is that the symbols, rituals, and images he resorted to were mainly expressions of his aesthetic political outlook. In other words, I'm advising against looking at symbols and rituals in a functionalist way. Or, somewhat paradoxically, I would suggest that fascist symbols and rituals were carrying a much heavier burden in terms of their function. They were truly supposed to have a transformative, molding power. They deeply informed how Mussolini conceived and exercised power and were not mere tools to buttress his control over state and society. But I don't want to get ahead of myself. Let's take up the strands of my argument one by one. First, the idea of politics as transformative, then the symbolic expressive means through which such vision was implemented and carried out by Mussolini. Finally, one could speculate on the effectiveness of the semiotic apparatus Mussolini's government set up. Grounding my whole analysis is the argument that Mussolini subscribed to the notion of aesthetics promoted by the art for art's sake movement, that is, the notion of art as autonomous and self-referential and detached from worldly matters. And at the same time, and somewhat paradoxically again, Mussolini had a great intuition about the crucial role of affect in politics, an intuition that, combined with his approach to aesthetics, gave way to the strange and lethal alchemy that we know of as fascism. Walter Benjamin was the first to associate fascism with an aesthetic approach to politics, an approach that he saw as representative of modern antinomies. The evocative and disturbing image Benjamin conjured to make his argument was the comparison of bombed-out sites in Ethiopia to blooming flowers, a comparison drawn by the leader of the futurist avant-garde movement, Filippo Tommaso Marinetti, from the height of the flying plane dropping those bombs during Italy's colonial war. For Benjamin, such an image implied an aestheticized view of violence and war, of destruction and pain, an artistic transfiguration that overcame bodily material reality. Benjamin argued that the deadening of sense perception reflected in the image of blooming flowers instead of mangled Ethiopian bodies paradoxically ensued from a heightened sensitivity to which modern life's fast pace subjected its dwellers. The myriad stimuli hitting individuals in their daily routine while walking in the street, crossing crowds, and eschewing tramways led to the opposite effect on numbing the senses, to the point, in the case of Marinetti's poem, of turning death and explosions into innocuous images, a spring festival. The shock experienced in combat is transformed and sublated by the perspective from far high in the sky and out of the mechanical invention of the time, the airplane. For Benjamin, the paradox was that when what he called the age of mechanical reproduction, rather than fulfilling its natural mission of freeing the people from the chains of an enchanted vision of the world, one that made people feel minuscule and in awe of authority, ended up becoming an instrument of domination. Liberation was countered by submission. Freed from the dogma of the church and other institutions, thanks to the availability of information and new technologies, the so-called masses were prey to re-enchantment, especially through new charismatic styles of politics that fed off myths and rituals, the case of Mussolini's Italy. This idea of anesthetized aesthetics, or anesthetic, to use an expression by Susan Buckmore, perfectly captures Mussolini's approach to politics and his role in the government of the polity. How was his politics anesthetic? In my research on Mussolini's writing and speeches, the trope of the politician as artist emerged as one of the strongest and most frequent, and not as a mere formula or superficial reference, but as a core feature of Mussolini's own understanding of politics. In Mussolini's view, for politics not to be a dirty word that reflected the failing political class's style of endless debates and conservative behavior, it had to play a role much more active and daring. Politics was supposed to change a society's whole way of living and thinking. The issue was not one of mere shifts in government, the old game of political compromises and formulas. With fascism, the goal was to revolutionize the meaning of politics itself in order to construct a new Italy on the ruins of the old one. Here is where the idea of the politician as artist comes in. The artist-politician destroys in order to create. Molding, sculpting, and shaping were terms that became familiar in Mussolini's language when referred to the masses and their transformation into ideal fascist models. Politics was an art for Mussolini, and he liked to think of himself as a sculptor who alone could render hard material into malleable constructions. I believe there is nothing more radical in terms of disregard for people, as well as the rules of democratic participation, than this approach that considers people as things an approach that, in my opinion, overlaps with and defines totalitarianism. The second element of fascism and study politics was the expressive means employed by Mussolini to actualize his role as artist politician. This is certainly the more familiar, visually evident, and even at times caricatured aspect of fascism and study politics. It encompasses the plethora of rituals and symbols which attracted the attention of many, including Hitler, during the early years of the regime. In part, the natural outcome of a movement that wanted to distinguish itself from traditional politics, in part a reflection of the youthful character of its members, and in part an expression of cultural trends of the time, fascism emerged as a semiotically rich phenomenon. Uniforms of adherents, although not colorful, were distinctive. Ritualistic ceremonies and gestures identified the special nature of the group. Myths framed the cultural horizon of its followers, and so on and so forth. Such semiotic access did not merely emerge at the origins of the movement, but continued to be augmented over time with new or newly redefined symbolic means. Their importance within the regime increased at times exponentially, such as in the case of the Roman salute, and of course of the myth of Mussolini. Though shifting in style and focus over the years, Mussolini's centrality in the fascist constellation remained unchallenged and ever-growing indeed. From lion tamer to rural worker, motorcyclist, father, commander, Mussolini's figure affirmed fascism value and helped build fascism as a long-standing regime. This leads me to the last element of my discussion, the effectiveness of Mussolini's aesthetic approach to politics. The question is tricky because there is no exact way to know the answer. What motivates me to raise this issue is, however, not so much the desire to find definite answers, but the need to emphasize once again the Mussolini's deep subscription to an aestheticized understanding of politics led him to play down the outcome of his approach. Mussolini believed that the goal of remaking the Italians would naturally be attained. It was not an issue of if or how. Changes in the Italians' gestures, rituals, ways of speaking would necessarily bring about the change he was pursuing. Mussolini had undeniable faith in this project and was not very rational about it, I would underline, which again demonstrates the radical nature of his subscription to an aesthetic understanding of politics. Now, for the final thing, my discussion, time up, should I not talk about this? Just one thing. I want to advocate that my analysis of fascism and aesthetic politics does not imply that all connections between aesthetic and politics are pernicious. And I can stop there, but I just wanted to add that.
That's great. Thank you very much.